Kill no one who I am. That's the way to survive. Well, I don't want to survive. I want to live.
Break!
I was at a library in Westchester, or else again though, and I was looking at a really clean looking library too, with a lawn. I mean, with sort of like a big grassy park in front of it, and trees, and kids are catching frisbees, and people are walking their dogs, and there's no trash anywhere, no graffiti anywhere. The air is clean, and everything is just sort of idyllic. And I'm sitting there because I live just outside of Englewood, off of Century and Western, and you know, the trash, of course, drives me crazy. I see people go to McDonald's, park on my street, literally throw a bag of McDonald's out onto the road, get up and walk into their apartment. I've seen folks do that, and it's just like, it's just the thing to do.
Yeah.
Because the thing that I want to see in the black community, this is my vision, my goal, and my friends tell me all the time, showing you dreaming.
Well,
I want to see a philosophy where black people take on this concept. I don't know where you're going, but you're going to get the hell up out of here.
But see the things. So I asked myself the question. I said, "What is really the difference between folks, you know, over on, in my neighborhood and where I'm sitting here in you know, this largely white community of Westchester?" And I realized the fact that as a general rule, the people who live in this community where I'm sitting at are, you know, they own their own, you know, these people own their own homes. Very oftentimes they own their own businesses. They can decide where they want to send their kids to school, because they can send them to private schools or what have you if they wish. They pay taxes, which isn't to say that most black people don't pay taxes too, but it's a much higher percentage in their case. They feel as if they own their community directly. Whereas with black people, we're basically told where to live through government housing assignments. In many cases, we're told how long basically we can be out on the streets by an oftentimes occupational seeming police force. We're limited and steered into terms of where we can send our kids to school, because the way the educational system is set up is that your zip code basically determines 90% of your child's educational and professional future. So even in the context of 21st century America, and why we can point out so many bright and beautiful exceptions, for this enormous chunk of black America, we still feel as if we're being controlled, because in many senses we are, you know? And when you feel like that, it's hard not to rebel against even your own environment, because you feel as if it's not really yours. You've just been put here.
Yeah, but,
you know?
But here's
at that
the, here,
point, it's not yours because you haven't grabbed it. You haven't taken
but
it.
Here,
like, yo, this
well,
is
and,
mine.
And that's the transition in mentality we need to make. We need to be able to honestly recognize our circumstances, but then say, nevertheless, this is our home, this is where we're at, and we do have power. And we recognized that some decades back, because there was an objective. We knew that desegregation was important for whatever other setbacks it incurred. And we went out and we fought that battle, and we largely won. So now it's time for us to coalesce and to fight this new battle.
Well, I think,
we've got
I think
to get
to
the
to
point
teach
where
people
we're
how to fight.
Transitioning into the mentality
of,
necessary
of
to make
a problem
that happen.
That I see in South Central Los Angeles. And when you talk to homeowners over in the 59th, where I used to be a chair as a Republican, and I would get out and talk to them, one of the things I heard often by black homeowners is that they're inundating this community with Section 8 vouchers. Mm. The way Section 8 vouchers work, they can put you in these low-income housing properties, rental properties, and people doing it in their houses, but it's low in the value, and you don't know who your neighbors are.
Mm-hmm.
And I ask myself, okay, so if that's a law, and a majority of the people in my district were Democrats and voted for Barack Obama, I'm like, okay, you voted for him 98%. You had better go ask for something while he's in office. Why don't you put a demand or ask for that? When you get a Section 8 voucher and you put in a low-income community that's next door to somebody's resident, you have to stay there for at least 5 years. Stop this, you move every year. because you now have no vested interest in that community.
Mm-hmm. You don't care what you do to the property.
We have to teach black people how to work within a system that benefits us. That Section 8 voucher where everybody can move after a year, I know I'm going to get the hell up out of here in a year. I don't give a shit about what happened in your neighborhood that you are paying taxes on your house.
And see what ends up happening, it was an article that happened recently where they were saying part of the reason why black people suffer when they come to purchasing it, when it comes to purchasing property anyway, is because we have a tendency to purchase in our neighborhoods, which tend to be considered more low-income neighborhoods. If we make investments, they tend to be in extremely lower-income neighborhoods. And what owners end up doing is looking for property that they can get Section 8 vouchers on because that's guaranteed money.
Yeah. And I don't have a problem. People are going to do their business the way they want to do it, but I'm saying make some provisions in the way people are doing business that it's not harming your community.
Right.
It's enhancing it.
Right.
And you know if one of the things that if people have their children, they have kids, and they're there for 5 years, their kids are growing up with your kids. They're networking and now they have a vested interest. When that Section 8, when that 5 year Section 8 voucher is up, they don't want to move because they're part of a community.
Right.
And the goal and I'm asking black people to start thinking about how to work within the context of what you have, make it work for you and not against you.
Agreed.
Do you know what the rationale is for why they have it to be 1 year? Because this 5 year thing sounds perfect. I mean, this is that people can have it's the
same,
something.
It's the same process when we implemented other programs like food stamp programs. It starts out with a great intention, but nobody monitors it and sees the long-time effects of it. So when the whole thing around welfare and whatever, so that black women couldn't have their husband
you would
in the
move,
house.
You would, is the idea that you would be off of Section 8 in a year so that you wouldn't need it, but it ends up being that you end up having to reply the next year and therefore can't keep the same. Why is it? Well, a year seems so very arbitrary.
I think the way that they treated the Section 8, that voucher, it had a great concept, but the reason nobody has wanted to change it is because look who it affects. It's the same way with the prison system. The reason
it could be they would think it's a welfare state where you're allowing people to be on Section 8 for 5 years. That's a long time to be subsidizing somebody's rent.
Well,
do you know if after that year period they have to reapply and that's why they wind up moving? Or
well, the way Section 8 works, because I was on it.
Right.
The way Section 8 works.
Nice.
Yeah. I tell black people, I'm going to teach you from what I know, not what somebody said.
Right.
The way Section 8 works is that if you, whatever conditions created for you to get it and qualify for it, you have it for the rest of your life.
Mm-hmm. So it actually follows the tenant
and it's based on your income. And most black people have gotten hip to it. As long as I keep my income below a certain level, I'm gonna do a hustle.
Most black people have gotten hip to it.
Yeah, it's really.
So you're saying that most black people in LA are on Section 8?
No, I'm saying the blacks who figured out how to get it have made it work for them. So they're saying, okay, I'm on Section 8. I'm not gonna lose this because especially here in Los Angeles, the average one bedroom in this city right now is going out almost at 1,000. So if you are a black person right now and you're unemployed, we talk about the high unemployment rate, and they can qualify and get on Section 8, they are qualifying for a nice place to live, and they're not having to use all their income to pay it. So to me, that's just a black person saying, I got to work within the system. What I'm saying is, I'm not trying to stop those blacks from doing the Section 8. I'm saying to black people who are getting up every day, who are homeowners, who have to get up and go to work and pay their bills, you're living next door to somebody that's home all day. You had better figure out how that person respects your community, because that Section 8 person is not going to give up that voucher, and you need your job. And what I'm saying is we have these two situations living side by side to each other. And I'm like, if I can't change it, how can I make it work for me? And I'm saying,
well, yeah, because
black homeowners, you stop letting people take those vouchers and move in and out of your neighborhood like it's a swinging door.
Well, yeah, and it's also something that creates a degree of social division and friction. I mean, I've been to neighborhood council meetings with, you know, middle class homeowners who are, you know, up in arms about all the Section 8 people in their neighborhood and so forth. But, you know, it creates a condition where people aren't helping each other, where, you know, you have folks who, you know, are in a difficult situation in terms of their income. But, you know, suddenly you've got, I hate to use the term class warfare, but it's sort of a manifestation of that within it's an us against them thing, from, you know, people who are relatively middle class to people who are on public assistance. It is worth making a study and understanding why it is the Section 8 program is designed the way it is, because it would be worth understanding that the reason behind the frequency and moving and so forth, and if there was some positive concept behind that and what the reason for that is. I feel like we need clarity on that. But the problem that Sean has identified, I think, is very real. and is worth.
I agree, you know, but then me, I would put the onus on the homeowners, depending that, you know, half of the houses on the street aren't all Section 8 houses. But mm-hmm. I would just say, like, you kind of have to build a community, like, mm-hmm. and you know, and Kim knows that I have like some radical ideas. I'd be like, yeah, you better send your kid to that school down the street, and you better start that PTA, and you better make sure that all the wealthy, mm-hmm. affluent folks who live on Hepburn and 6th Ave are in the PTA. They have a booster club. They raise $20,000 at the beginning of every year, mm-hmm. and Tom Bradley Middle School becomes the beacon, elementary becomes the beacon. I really do believe in community building so that you set the standard, or being like, yo, I got Lowe's to donate trees. We're going to have a tree planting, whatchamacallit, on our street. But it's hard when, like you said, when, you know, half of the neighborhood is Section 8 homes and yeah. they mm-hmm. like, what? We don't mm-hmm. care about planting no tree.
You're talking about a mentality now.
Right.
This, you know what I'm saying? You're talking about
it goes deep.
People that's growing up like that, that's teaching their kids from, because they don't know no better. The parenting, you know what I'm saying? The single household families. Dad ain't there. I'm gonna be on the street. I'm gang banging. You know what I'm saying? You're talking about that whole thing.
But wouldn't you agree that a community like this area here, the Crenshaw District, that group that you're talking about that's perpetuating a cycle, they're the minority. They're not the majority. And my attitude is the majority can embrace that minority. You know what I'm saying? Because it is our job to bring them in and break that cycle. Like, yes, your parents may be teaching you something in your home, but when you come out and you come over to my house, this is what we do in my house. Now, I'm not telling you and your mother what to do when you go home, but you have a different version that when you're growing up, you have seen two different worlds.
That's very true.
Even though you may be exposed to something that's new that can get you out of a situation, like change your whole life, you're talking about a mentality, man. It's something that's just embedded in you. You know what I'm saying? It's going to take more than that just for them to even have that hope. You know what I'm saying? To even have that spark in their mind. Because that's the thing that has to change. You know what I'm saying? That person has to feel like, well, shit, man, I can make it too. You know what I'm saying?
This is what I'm saying. That's the spark. Black people, that is our responsibility. Because we have the information. We have the resources. It is now incumbent upon us to stop sending our resources outside our community and invest in what you're talking about. Yes,
I think
because we have to start somewhere.
But we look at, I think middle class black folks look at lower class black folks and we look down on them.
It's like what you were saying earlier.
I'm not
saying
I do, but there is. It becomes like what it says. It becomes like a little class warfare. Like we're better than them, or they're ghetto, or they're whatever. And the embracing is like a lot of times we embrace them so that they can lose who they are and become who we are or whatever. And that's not what real embracing is. And you got to accept people for who they are. For who they are. In their
and
spirit,
meet them where they are.
But then if you have something that they want, be willing to share it. Like, oh, this is how I got it, and vice versa. If they have something that you want, like, how do you do this? I don't know.
Believe it or not, man, people think like, you know what I'm saying, it is a crab in a barrel effect. You know what I'm saying? A lot of people they push people down to get to where they need to get to the top. So those people that have achieved, let's say middle class black folk, you know what I'm saying, that have achieved, you know what I mean? They thinking like, man, fuck that. I'm not finna fuck this up for nothing. I worked too hard. I'm serious though. I worked too hard to get where I am. You know what I'm saying? Yeah, I'm for the black community and the public side, but on the real, it's like, man, shit, you ain't finna take what I got. You know what I'm saying? And that's a bad mentality. That's a mentality, man, because don't nobody really understand what it would be like if we all did come together and, you know what I'm saying,
and that's because
uplift the community.
Because
you know what
there
saying?
Was a time that the situation is identical to the way it is now with all the real-life situations. You had poor blacks. You had middle-class blacks. What happened is that we have to find our way back to what I call the era of the 1940s and 50s. It's not living in the past. It's saying the ball was dropped. Because when I hear people talk about affirmative action, I think what we opted out with integration, I think all the blacks who were fighting to build a stronger black community, those blacks who fought to get us to the affirmative action era, I think what we got is not what they asked for. I think there were so many blacks who were struggling that when they throw through just this door open, so many blacks who had just been under the gun for so long, they accepted anything. But the people who had been strategically planning and fighting for certain things, they knew that there were offsets. They knew there were consequences. They didn't go in saying, we want to be integrated. We're saying, if we pay taxes on this side of town and you pay taxes on that side of town, we want those taxes dispersed equally. But what people opted out for was looking over across the tracks and on the other side of town saying that their ice water is colder than ours. Mm-hmm. And black folks, what we did was there was a certain group, because it was two black, it has always been two segments in the black community. What one segment of the black community opted out for was something easy. What they didn't understand, nothing you're going to get in this country is going to be easy. If somebody's giving you something that makes it seem easy on the front side, you might as well lean over because you're getting fucked on the backside.
And the thing is, we're at this point, neither side trusts the other. So the side that's upwardly mobile looks down on the side that is impoverished and dealing with all those struggles. And that side looks at us. What do you mean? I'm struggling like everybody else. I may not be completely impoverished, but I'm in the struggle. No, don't get it fucked up.
Don't get it twisted. Okay,
my dad. Echo in this house.
Right, because we can't afford no more furniture. The thing is, I just think
they got a second floor. Y'all.
Neither side.
We're moving on up.
Hilarious.
I gotta go.
I know we all. I got to get to bed. Neither side though trusts the other. So in terms of trying to get people involved, you're trying to embrace people. People are looking at each other like, "What's your motive? Why do you want me to come into your life?" You know what I'm saying? And the other side is like, why would I want to bring you into my life? I don't trust you. You might come into my shit and take something mess something up.
And I think the role for us as we're talking around this table, those of us who are aware of it, I think the challenge that is before us is to figure out how to bridge those two.
Yeah,
because
it is.
Somebody has to do that work.
Yeah.
And if we're having a conversation tonight talking about it, at least we're aware that
it exists.
Mm-hmm. Now, how do we do about it? We may not even solve it in our lifetime, but at least we're laying a foundation for others to build upon.
I agree.
I think, man, what would really help too, and I'm kind of like going aside from the subject, but like, let's say, for instance, the light-skinned black and the dark-skinned black. You know what I'm saying? Those two different colors, they look at each other differently. You know what I'm saying? Light-skinned people think, like, you know what I'm saying, they got the good hair, that so forth, so on. I'm a little better. It's true. You know what I'm saying? So if...
Are you saying it's true that they are better?
No. I'm saying it's true that that's how they think.
Yeah.
It's true that that's how they think. You know what I'm saying?
But nobody wants to speak on it, though.
Nah, but if you can't even get past that, you know what I'm saying? How you going to even get past, like, trying to come together as a whole?
But don't try to. This is what I'm telling black people. There's certain. What I'm trying to tell black people is there's just don't try to get past it. Teach the light skinned brother and the dark skinned brother to say, okay, which one of us can get in and get it and bring it back? If a light skinned brother has access to things that I as a dark skinned brother don't have, I'm not going to make you my enemy. I'm going to make you my partner because we can both access. And I think that's what we need to teach on the light skinned dark skinned. Yeah. Not fight each other, but fight together to figure out how you can improve your condition.
The problem is the people who benefit separate themselves. And that's something that Chris is speaking to that people don't want to talk about. And I've mentioned this on, it might have been when we did the Brown Girl Hour one time. And mind you, I have family on both ends of the spectrum. That's a new podcast. You ain't
Tash.
You ain't been listening.
I said, I was like, you were in a brown girl?
As brown as I am, yes. Yo ass girl. But I have family members on both ends of the spectrum. There are people who have seen benefit because they are fair complected and have been treated differently and have been told if I behave a certain way, act a certain way, do my hair a certain way, step my makeup game a certain way, people won't even really pay attention to color so much and I can do X, Y, and Z. And versus thinking to themselves, I'm still a black person and I still need to help my people and I got family members that are darker than me who could benefit from what I get my benefits from. They completely separate themselves and say, nah, I'm going to get away with as much as I can get away with. And if that means pushing away from you and moving more towards these people, that helps me out. Like, for instance, I'm reading this book, The Senator and the Socialite, that talks about this husband and wife that I forget all the details, but basically the wife's family came from an upwardly mobile black family her whole life. I think both of her parents were mixed race, but they were both really, really fair skinned. They end up moving from the South to the North. And when they move to the North, they begin to look for an upwardly mobile Black community. But then they found a community of abolitionists, white abolitionists, that readily accepted Black people. And for them, it was a wiser move to connect with those white abolitionists than to connect with upwardly mobile Black people, because that set them apart from everybody. And that's where they saw that for them, that was a benefit for them. That was a benefit for their children. And I'm saying that there are some people on the fair complected end of the spectrum who have seen that benefit. There's also some brown skin people who have married into, you know, they have interracial relationships or whatever, and they move into a world that is predominantly white and kind of remove themselves from Black people because they've seen benefit and how they're treated, how they're respected. And they don't even think, I could be using this to help other people come up. That's not even part of the game.
And I think to add to that, because I don't want to get the perception that only light-skinned Blacks are taking advantage of opportunities.
And it's not all light-skinned Blacks.
There are dark-skinned Black people, my complexion, who are marrying white people to do the same thing. And I'm like, they both have the same impact on our community.
Right. Exactly.
If you're finding a way to escape who you are, and leaving a certain segment of our society behind, you have a greater responsibility to turn that tide around now, because things are changing in our society. We cannot educate all these Black people. We cannot have all these professional Blacks and have all this self-Black hate.
Agreed. Right.
And that would lead me to the point of, like, how do we get to that place, you know, of having a group of African-Americans upwardly mobile? For me, we can see a better benefit if we start investing in our children. We've got to start teaching them the importance of sustaining a Black community and what's unacceptable, because right now they're growing up in it and they think it's acceptable. They are going to be the people that are making the decisions in the next 20, 30 years, or they aren't going to be making the decisions. Our children won't have anything to say about it if we don't start pouring into them right now, the type of careers, where we need them to go, what type of, how do they will sustain their own community.
And I think the way you do that is that you model it. If we're saying young Blacks should come along and do this, what's the model that they see of us doing it already? And I'm asking the adults to take a serious look at what we need to do right now in this time, because young Blacks who are watching us, they're only going to duplicate what they see.
Right. And mm-hmm. I think even deeper than that, they're not even watching us anymore. They're not watching us. We are going to have to get, as a person in education, they're not looking at us anymore. We've got to get in their face and lay the blueprint down.
Now I want to separate a little bit from that, and I'll tell you why. I have some Black friends who grew up under this entitlement mentality. And a lot of Blacks said, well, they weren't showing, they're not looking. I say, it's funny, they think they're not looking. You'd be surprised what people are paying attention to when they need it. When the Blacks that I'm talking about, when they found themselves going into mainstream America and they were up against things that they were not familiar with, they reflected on people that they saw who had done something. So they're watching us. They just may not be giving us credit. But when their back's up against the wall, it's the same thing like when your parents will say, wait till you have children. You may not be doing what I'm saying do right now, but the moment they have children, you ever notice that parents, kids raise their children the way their parents raised them?
Right. But I'm talking about student children. I'm talking about the youth today. You stop a youth, they're not looking at us as their role models anymore. They're not paying attention to us. They are so pulled from the Black community because we don't have a Black community to show them other than where they are, and it ain't necessarily good. So we literally have to get in their face and speak into them that there was a Black community. There is a Black community different from what you're seeing. And it's not this violence. It's not drug dealing. It's not, you know, pulling each other down. It's not get rich quick. There is a good life because they have totally separated themselves from it. When you talk about positive Black images to them, their eyes open up because they're like, that's old stuff. You know, the children today have a certain mentality of every man for himself, and they're not even looking at themselves as Black.
Now, my spiel on that, this is Sean. My spiel on that is this. I was on the bus the other day, and I saw these youth, and I guess they were around 15 or 16 years old. They were all at the back of the bus, and the majority of the bus was Latino, and all the Latinos stayed to the front, and they let those few Blacks have the whole back section. And I'm saying to myself, okay, these young Blacks are depicting a certain perception of themselves, and people are going to treat them based on that perception. What I'm looking at now, and I'm saying to myself, Sean, how do you turn this around right away where you don't have years to fix this problem? I think we have to do what other black communities are finding themselves doing around the country. We have to impose certain curfews. If you are not on your way to a job or to school, I don't want to see you during the day. I don't give a shit what your problem is. I don't want to see your ass.
But you know what?
I think we have to become firmer as black leaders. We can't just let anything go. When we see these young brothers who you say are not paying attention, what I'm saying is you don't have an option not to pay attention because you ain't paying no bills.
Right. But at the same time, they don't have a cause. We had causes. We were just talking about this the other night. We grew up in the time of the L.A. riots, Rodney King, here in Southern California. We had a cause. These kids don't have a cause. So to them, the world is at their fingertips, and they don't have to pull up the next man that looks like them or the next man. It's an every man for himself mentality. And so we've got to get in the faces of them, in the faces of our children.
Would you say that mentality, I call it an entitlement mentality. And one of my siblings was having problems with her children. And she was like, well, Sean, what do I do? I said, you undo what you did.
Right.
If you gave them all that stuff, take it away.
Right.
And I think this mentality of this disrespect and everything, I think the middle class black community, I'm calling on them. It is our responsibility to now put an end to some of this foolishness. Right. These young kids have no power. Why are we letting them act like they're running something?
Because we haven't poured anything. You say disrespect. I say they don't have any respect for themselves. So like what's coming out as disrespect is lack of respect for themselves or for anything else. Like we have this black pride, this black community. They don't have that. You know, they're in their enemy might be the police. Mm. At most, you stop a young kid. What's the biggest issue facing you today? It's very individualized. Like I'm poor, or you know, something very individualized. They don't see a community problem. Those kids are far and few.
Well, I think the point that you're making is spot on in terms of the fact that if you don't have something that you can see in front of you, a role model, a community that embodies the values that we're talking about, it's extremely difficult to replicate that in your personal being and your personal thoughts and behavior, or even to know that you really should. Because whereas you might have a parental figure, an authority figure, try and speak, you know, those values into you, even if it's your mother or your father, it's really difficult to contend with the day-to-day images that you get through the TV, through the radio, and in your own neighborhood, especially depending on where you might be. But for those who know, and this is what I hear Sean saying, for those of us who know, and you know, black middle class, but just, you know, black folks who remember or have some sense through their own experience and education as to what it is the community should look like and must look like, it's important for us to interact with each other. Those of us who at least should know better. Because young folks, you know, they're looking at us. If we're not really exemplifying the things that we want them to reflect, then it's more on us than it is on them. So if we elevate, I think, our mode of conversation, if we educate our people, but also, you know, strive for excellence within our families, but to always be sure not to define excellence, to what you were talking about earlier, Kim, as escaping from the black community, which is how we've defined excellence among black people for so long. Exactly. But to define excellence as not only achievement for yourself, but achievement on behalf of the community of which you are part. And that has to be our attitude, that we're seeding on behalf not just of ourselves, but of one another, you know? And that's something that I believe we will do, because the only other option is the permanent stagnation paralysis of the black community in America and America itself, really, you know, because I frankly am of the opinion that America needs black people to be successful, because frankly, we built this country with the sweat on our backs, you know, and I think we ought to continue to do so. But we've got to see to it that we've built ourselves up to make that happen.
I was watching this. I was watching flipping through the channels, and I'll turn to 106 in Park. You know what I'm saying? I hadn't seen that show in a long, long, long time. So just so happened I turned to it. It was this particular rap group on there. You know, it was maybe about five of them. And one of the guys from that group said, I guess the host asked him something, and one of the guys from that group said, man, I can't even read. You know what I'm saying? I don't even know how to read. I can't even read. And was like, you know, hyped about it and happy. You know what I'm saying? Because he's basically saying like, shit, I don't even need an education to do this. You know what I'm saying? I could be here right now doing this. But it's like millions. And you know, kids watch that show. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? So he's influencing to the kids like, shit, just imagine a kid that already feel, have low self-esteem, already come from a broken home, broken family. Yeah, he's just like, oh, shit, man. I don't need to do nothing else, man. I'm finna do this my way. I ain't finna graduate. You know what I'm saying?
Why were more black people upset with at that him. As opposed to Donald Sterling? Mm-hmm. That is much more devastating to us than anything Donald Sterling does mm-hmm. or say.
Mm-hmm.
Because that show just put in the minds of millions of young blacks, like he said, who may be already struggling, and somebody just reaffirmed their humanity in a negative way.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I'm sitting here saying to myself, what is wrong with us as middle-class black people that our priorities are that screwed up?
It goes back to what I was saying earlier in regard to us being impressed with money. Because, Sean, I can tell you, before I even started Black Is, one of the things that I used to be kind of crazy little militant on was the amount of ignorance that was coming out of hip-hop culture there in, like, the 90s, early millennium. It was a lot, and I don't want to get too deep off into the conversation, but I will say this. To me, with the advent of Southern rap, not Outkast being the exception, it was a lot of just bullshit I was hearing coming out of the music. A lot of glorifying of drug usage and like crazy drug usage, violence, foolishness, and no depth to the music, no depth to the lyrics. And I would argue with people. Why are we listening to this shit? What are they even
allowing it?
Right. What are they even saying? And the people's response, oh, you got to stop hating. They doing what they got to do. They making money. They doing this. They doing that. They pulling themselves up. And us glorifying the idea that no matter how we get money, as long as we getting money, it don't matter. As long it doesn't matter if it's detrimental to us or anybody else. As long as we getting it, it's all good. To the point where you feel like you're fighting this battle. Yeah, and you're fighting this battle, and there's not enough people on your side. If they are, they're not willing to speak out about it because either they consume it, they enjoy the consumption of the bullshit, or they don't want to come off seeming like a hater, or they too glorify the money. You know what I mean? And so they're kind of like, yeah, they're doing ignorant shit, but hey, you know what I'm saying?
And I would say to all the people who are listening to this program tonight, just like ignorance can garner a group of more ignorant people, intelligent people can do the same. And what we're in a fight now for our survival. And I'm asking every black person who's fed up, who's seen the destruction and the moral decay of our communities as black communities around this country, you can sit on the sidelines and watch it continue, or you can come out of your houses and unify with any black wherever you at and say, what are we going to do about this?
Right. I agree. I think, man, I wish we could have this kind of conversation with, you know, podcasters or people in general across the nation and actually building and making decisions about what we're
because
going
we
to
can.
Do actively.
We have enough intelligent people around this table, and this is in Los Angeles. There are intelligent black people all over this country.
Right.
What we're not doing is unifying our efforts.
We're not working collectively. We're just focused on the individual, and it's collective work that needs to happen in order for change to actually be made.
So they say take a village to raise
a child. Yeah.
And we're all living in individual cardboard boxes.
Mm-hmm. Well, we thank you so much for listening to all parts of this Black Is Break that poor Christopher Layman is going to have to chop and screw and get back to y'all. Thank you so much. Tune in next time. Peace.
Thank you.